We ready? Can we go?
Yeah, we can go. Yeah, go ahead.
Ready?
Yep.
Okay. Ready?
Ready?
Okay. It's like Radiolab. Okay. Male Kemp. That's funny. All right, so it is. It's we're going. I'm going.
Yep.
I'm going.
Roll into
I'm
it.
Going. I'm not waiting anymore. I'm going. Like Baldwin, they all here. All right, I'm going.
Wait, what's that from?
Glengarry Glen.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
brass balls.
That's
Go ahead.
That's what it takes to sell real estate. That's what it takes to do this show.
A B C.
That's right. Always be chimping.
Oh, this is going to be rare form right here. This is going to be good stuff. Go ahead.
A, always, B, B. I love, that's my favorite one.
The B, B is B. B. Yeah. Like,
Baldwin.
It's so sad that Mamet is so insane because he's kind of a genius.
He is a genius.
See you at the meet.
I'd like to get Mamet and Sorkin in the same room.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, Mamet.
All right. So it's Tuesday. It's the On Taking Pictures program.
Thanks, Dave.
Yeah. Episode 143. And we're here talking about the photography and the creativity and nonsense that keeps us going.
Yeah.
Yeah. My name is Jeffrey Sidoris from Faded and Blurred, and with me, you know, you're just fancy. Bill Wadman.
I like being fancy. Fancy's good.
Hey, two things before
okay.
we...
Okay. Number one?
Number one.
A, B, C.
A, always, B, B. She would have, like, paused for a beat there. Just yeah. like, B, B. I was listening to Mark Maron. You ever listen to WTF?
Yes. Which episode?
Schwartzman.
Haven't listened to it. I will admit before listening to what you're about to say and say that there's something about Jason Schwartzman. I know he's probably a very nice guy and I like him in some of his roles, but there's something about him that makes me worry that he's a jerk. But go ahead. Finish what you're saying.
Okay. I love Jason Schwartzman.
Well, that's probably why I don't like you either.
Probably. I've seen his band, well, his former band, Phantom Planet.
Okay.
And I think he's terrific. What I didn't know, and this is surprising, I had no idea that his mother was Talia Shire.
Yes.
Had no idea.
Oh, yeah. He's in that whole family.
And then, the Uncle Francis.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he's a Coppola.
I had no idea.
You didn't?
Nope.
Okay.
Nope. But it was interesting that the first 10 minutes of the show, they're sort of fetishizing gear because Schwartzman sits down and Mark uses the Shure SM7 mm-hmm. mics and Jason's like, oh man, this is a really nice mic. And he's like, yeah, SM7, right? And Maren's like, yeah, you have one of these? He's like, no, I've always wanted one though. And so they go into this whole thing about how Schwartzman, like late at night, he'll just, you know, look at websites or catalogs of gear just because he loves the way it looks, you know.
that's a fetish right there.
Yeah, he just loves the design of it. I mean, I just thought it was really funny.
I think Schwartzman could probably afford a Shure SM7.
I think
he's just putting that out there. All right, yeah. So what's number two?
Well, number one, not done yet.
Oh,
so,
okay.
So they talk about his music career,
yeah.
And they talk about his acting career. They talk about he created a new show that's on Amazon Prime called Mozart in the Jungle.
I have seen an episode.
Yeah, it's Gael Garcia Bernal. Bernadette Peters is in it. Malcolm McDowell is in it.
Yeah,
it's a terrific cast, and he's one of the creators. And I just thought it was so funny that, not funny, but interesting that he's got his fingers in so many pies, but he's not sort of more well known than he is. You know, given the history of film that he's done, given his family history, you know, it's just, he's sort of like.
Well, because he always plays in the background.
Yeah, he's that guy. It's like, oh, I know that guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, he is in a lot of different stuff. And I think of guys at that level in today's world, all of them have a number of things going on. It's just whether or not you ever hear about them, you know. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They're throwing lots of things at the wall, seeing what sticks. And a lot of it doesn't stick, right, you know.
Well, and one of the other things that I thought was great was he spends 3 hours a night writing.
Yeah.
Every night. Like, that's his kind of routine, that you have to do the work to get the results. You don't wait until something strikes. You pull it. Creativity is just as much editing as it is inspiration.
Yeah, absolutely. Is he single? He's not married.
No, he's married. He's got three.
Oh, he's got two kids. Yeah.
Two children.
You're right. Yeah.
This whole thing, this almost obsessive need to create kind of leads into this first thing.
Okay.
And I was on the train. I went into LA this weekend and was shooting pictures.
Okay.
And excuse me, on the way, there was a woman sitting two rows in front of me, kind of on the end of the train. So her seats were facing me. Right. Sure. So I'm facing the end of the car and she's facing back at me. And she's on her mobile phone talking to a friend of hers. And she's talking about how she's close to getting a job at the MTA, right? At the Metro.
Okay.
And how if she gets this job, she's going to be set for life. And those were the words she used. I will be set for life. and this is going to, bear with me for a minute.
Yeah, sure.
Listeners. And I don't mean this to be dismissive or disparaging in any way. But I thought to myself, how wonderful. And again, I'm not trying to be patronizing in any way. How wonderful it would be sometimes if my life were that simple.
If a certain job would mean that you were set for life.
If I could just do this job, whatever that job is, I have my 9-to-5, I do it.
You know you're never going to get fired. You know it's going to be around for 50 years.
Right. And I am not plagued, because that makes it sound too desperate. But at some points it is. Not to feel that you have to create something, to put something into the stream in order to validate your own existence.
Yeah. Well,
how liberating on some level that must be.
Sure. Well, it's sort of like, you know, wouldn't it be easier to not be the kind of person who thinks about all this stuff too much?
Right. And that's what I mean. And again, I'm not trying to say, you know, I'm not trying to be patronizing at all. I get so paralyzed by the minutia of my own life.
Yeah.
And feeling like, you know, I have spent 6 weeks on a blog post. And then at the end of it, I go, it's a effing blog post. Who cares?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then that little voice goes, you do.
Yeah. Right. Well, I think all of that is fine if you are satisfied by your own satisfaction. Right. So if you spend 6 weeks on a blog post and you think it's great and it comes out and no one reads it or no one cares, you have to be okay that you were happy with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, well.
But are you?
That's the thing. Are you?
Right.
And listening to this woman talk to her friend, just parts of it reminded me of my father. As many of you know, if you've listened to this show before,
if you haven't, welcome. This is a good episode to start.
Yeah. My father was a railroad man. My father worked for the Southern Pacific Railroad.
There's got to be a railroad song we can insert here.
Yeah. My grandfather worked for the railroad. My father's brothers all worked for the railroad.
Yeah.
My grandfather's father, so my great grandfather worked for the railroad. So I was the first male in our family in four generations that didn't work for the railroad.
What the hell are you doing? Go get a job at the railroad.
My dad wanted me to, believe me. But the point is, my father was perfectly satisfied doing 10 or 12 hours for the railroad. And when he punched out, he didn't think about the job at all.
Right.
Not once. Right. He worked hard. He played hard. He bought houses. He bought cars. He got his pilot's license. He bought a plane. You know, he didn't take his work home with him ever.
Is part of that, though, due to the fact that working for something like the railroad, you know that when you clock out, somebody else is clocking in to do your job?
Maybe.
You know, there, somebody else is covering it while I'm not there, so it's okay. I don't have to worry about it.
Right. And I always felt bad that I didn't have that gene, you know,
felt bad envy, or felt bad like you were a failure because you didn't have the the gene?
Both.
Okay.
Both. You know, that why wasn't, and again, I can't stress enough that I'm not coming from a space of any sort of, you know, hierarchy. But why wasn't blue collar enough for me?
Yeah. Well,
why couldn't I be satisfied with that life?
The thing is that isn't just a blue collar thing. I mean, my sister works at the Smithsonian, which is almost a government job. You know, that's not going anywhere, you know, and part of that is the fact that you don't have to go anywhere, you know,
right.
People get their job at a law firm. And once they get in and they, you know, finish law school and get hired by a firm and get an offer, unless something really crazy happens or they screw up or want to leave, they'll probably be there for the rest of their lives, you know.
And I wonder if that's not generational, you know, my parents and his parents.
There are plenty of people in our generation and the younger generation who are looking for that, especially younger generation, people who can't find jobs at all. That sounds fantastic. You and I think, were in some ways lucky that when we got out of school in the 90s, there were jobs.
Right.
You know?
It was still a relatively new thing. You know, the pattern was you get a job, you work at that job until you retire, you get your watch and your pension, and, you know, 5 years later, you're gone, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So it was such an interesting.
And you're envious of this?
Sometimes, yes. Because I make my life more of a struggle than it has to be.
Well, at least you...
Or that's my perception.
Sure.
That's my perception.
Well, at least you realize that it's you doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, there's plenty of people in our situation, because I agree with you and I'm in the same boat for the most part, that will... that will think that, oh, society's doing this to me or other people. It's like, no, really, this is me doing this to me.
No. The only person dragging the relaunch, for example, of Faded and Blurred is me.
Right.
The only person dragging, doing more episodes of PD is me.
Right.
That's it.
Hey, look, I had a shoot on Friday for Pause, and it was fine. The pictures are fine. They're good. But I'm not happy with, I'm not satisfied with them. So I'm meeting up with the guy again today at his studio to shoot more pictures.
You know, it's
so it's like the client's perfectly happy. I'm not happy.
It happens. I did the same thing. By the way.
Yeah. By the by.
Brand new Craft and Vision podcast.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
That I am hosting. So, and the reason that I bring this up twofold: one, because I'm really excited that David Duchemin asked me to host a podcast for his company, which is super flattering and cool, and I can't tell you how amazing that is. But the first one I recorded with CJ Chilvers, and we had some connectivity issues at the beginning with Skype or whatever, and. I mean, you and I have gone through this. It just throws off your rhythm.
Yeah, sure.
It takes you out of it and throws you off because you're stopping, starting.
I did a video interview last week and they couldn't use the video because apparently it was too jumpy.
It just messes you up, right?
Yeah.
So CJ and I were talking and you know, I said, hey, would you mind taking another stab at this? And he said, no. He's like, I would love to. He's like, I want you to knock this out of the park. So let's do it again. So we did it the following morning, and I've done that with David. You know,
yeah, wasn't it Duschenman who you did that with the first time?
Yeah, I did it with David, and I said, you know, this is not representative of what we can do. And first of all, David Duschenman is an amazingly generous person with his time, with his energy, and he said, you know what, I'm flattered that. That's the way you want to proceed. And if you don't think it's your best, let's do it again.
Yeah.
You know, so there are times when you get the opportunity to do it again. But anyway,
the flip side is that you and I were both in creative versions of corporate jobs. Right.
Right.
And you know, I, for one, could have stayed doing what I was doing. And in many ways I would have kept getting work and, you know, continued the whole thing along, and I was set for life. Is that the term you used?
That's the term she used.
Okay. Yeah. So we both chose to do something different, right? Because for us, there wasn't, as much as I would love to have a standard paycheck every week, I also know that I love having the freedom to not have a standard paycheck every week, right? It's which one do you love more? Because everyone wants both of those things. I think everyone wants the freedom to do what they want and the stability that comes with not having the freedom. It's just, which do you want more, you know? Because very few people get to have both, you know? It's a very tricky thing. I had the guy I shot on Friday. We had to go
for the pause.
Yeah. For thing? Pause, this artist who has a show right now down at the Johnson & Johnson headquarters, which is in New Brunswick, New Jersey. So he and I met at Penn Station and took this train down to New Brunswick and we're talking on the way. And he's been making art for 30 years. This guy is, an artist and HIV positive and has been on retroviral drugs since 87. And, you know, like was in it. It's from the beginning, you know, as it were. And we were having this long discussion. You know, he's getting in his 50s now. You know, he's getting older. And I said, you know, you are known in your community, but of course most artists don't make a ton of money, you know? And he was sort of alluding to the fact that he's like a little worried about his future, you know, cause he's getting older now and whatnot. And I said, you know, what if some guy came in and said, look, I will buy everything you've got here. I'll give you $1 million and I'll buy everything, you know, tomorrow.
Right.
And I said, you know, would you take it? You know, that's enough money for you to, you know, move somewhere not incredibly expensive and live the rest of your life, you know? And he said, well, you know, I wouldn't want it to go into a private collection. You know, I'd rather, if it was a museum, maybe whatever it is. And I was like, dude, they're giving you $1 million. Like, here's your chance to be set for life, you know? And
but he still had
a hang up about it. Because he has that much respect for whatever it is he's doing, you know, it's more important to him, even though he was basically saying, I'm terrified that I'm going to be broke when I get old. He was also saying, but I'm not willing to give a compromise on my work, to make myself set for life.
Is it that he wants more people to experience his work? Is that the reluctance for a personal collection?
Yeah,
or a private collection?
And I said, you know what? Like, what if it's, you know, some guy who's collecting, you know, gay artists from New York from the 80s and 90s? You know, I mean, like, I'm sure there are rich guys out there who are putting together a specific collection towards AIDS-related art, because there's tons of it out there, you know? I'm sure there's guys like that. And many of them probably are going to do it, collected all their lives, and then sometime 30 years from now there will be a National AIDS Art Museum or something that all these people will give their stuff to or whatever, you know.
Couldn't you buy a body of work and you know, it's on loan from so and so to the museum.
They could do that, but I guess he wanted some sort of guarantee along those lines, you know.
Oh,
and I just found it fascinating. It's like, you know, you made the work, and we had a long discussion, which I'll get into in a minute, about his experience of making it versus the work that was left, the artifact, you know, that mm-hmm, was there.
Mm-hmm.
But for him, he was more invested in the work than he was invested in the fear, you know?
In the fear of what? His own death? Or
I think the fear of his own of poverty, you know?
Ah, okay. Okay.
So it's just, it was, I don't know. I found the whole thing fascinating. Like he had the chance to get the gold watch, you know, mm-hmm. or, you know, in my hypothetical.
Right.
And he didn't jump for it, you know? So it's just
interesting. On the other hand, if someone wants to buy all of my paintings that are up for $1 million.
Okay. But here's the thing.
Spell it E-R-Y.
Yeah.
Two D's.
Here's the thing though. What if you had been making art for 30 years constantly and it was, you know, rooms full of work and it was everything that you had to show for the last 30 years of your life?
Ask me in 20 something years.
Right. But you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Like that might be a little more difficult.
It's different.
You know? I guess it's, are you making it for the sort of catharsis of making it? Or does the viewing fit into your process, and is the viewing and in your friend's case, the public viewing,
yeah,
is that the last piece of the puzzle?
Well, that's the thing. We had this discussion about his work, because one of the things that he does is he was up at an artist commune up in New Hampshire or something years ago,
mm-hmm.
and he was taking a walk trying to find inspiration. And he saw this leaf on the ground that spoke to him. So mm-hmm. he picks up the leaf and he goes home and he used wire to create basically an outline of the leaf that he had found. And he dedicated it to one of his friends who had died. And he's since done this to over 200 different people in his life.
Wow.
Yeah. See, this is, and there's like a wall of all the leaves. Actually, there's a wall of 70 of them. And it's wow. a big wall.
And they're all just outlines?
All just the different, wire outline? Yeah, just the outlines, yeah.
Wow.
And part of it is apparently the shadow against the paper behind it, you know, which is kind of interesting.
Are they individual pieces or is it one
individual
giant?
Pieces.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay.
And each one is named after the person, which is kind of interesting. Wow. And not the real name, like it's, you know... If it wouldn't be Jeffrey Sidoris, it would be, you know, like 2-bit Jeffrey, you know, whatever his nickname for the guy was, you know.
Wow.
Sedede.
Right.
And it's really heavy stuff. But we had this conversation. I said, you know, I was talking about how he sees those, what he makes. And he was kind of saying something that you and I say a lot, which is that all he sees the art as the experience of making it, and the final object is just an artifact of that experience.
Right.
And so maybe for him, so for me, when I hear him say that, to me, that would mean that the artifact would mean less because it was the experience that he was really going for. And that's never going to go away, whether the artifact's there or not.
You know? Right.
But maybe for him, it was sort of a way for those people to see that art would somehow make them experience what he experienced when he was making it. And that's the idea. I don't know. The whole thing is fascinating to me. And it was really, it was a good conversation. You know, you get into these conversations with people. It's the best part about our jobs, you know?
I agree.
I mean, we get it. You and I get to it in different ways because we're going at it from different angles, but a lot of it is conversations with people, you know?
To sum up.
Yep.
Do you get a sense of because you've got in the show notes here, experience versus artifact.
Yeah.
Do you get a sense of what he values more, the experience in making the artifact or the final artifact itself, that final piece of art?
I think that it's the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And as I get older, I tend more and more toward that myself.
Mm-hmm.
But for whatever reason, I don't know. It's interesting. You know what it is? I think part of it is that there are artists who make things, right? And they want people to see them and they want people to experience them, and they're artists, you know?
Capital A.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there are people who are making art as a product. And that's not to necessarily take away from their art. It could be wonderful work. It could be special and miraculous and change the world. But somehow I think some people think about what they're making differently, in the sense that they know they're making a widget that they're able to let go of, you know? And I don't know what the distinction is between those two people, like why it is that one goes one way or the other. But can you
give me contemporary examples of both?
Well,
of each?
I think we both know. Well, okay, you a year ago or you now, right? You know, you loved your originals, and still do.
Still do, yeah.
But a mindset has switched where you're okay with it not being with you.
Right, but I don't make them as product. Like, I don't go, okay, I need a series of 10 to get out the door.
Okay.
Who does that?
Do you think Shepherd Fairey makes stuff to go out the door?
Yes.
Yeah.
But I also think he makes stuff to further his process and to make a point.
Absolutely.
And to say
something. He's willing to give away. He's willing to let go of the artifact, you know, obviously.
Where do you sit on somebody like Damien Hirst you could even say Richard Serra, people that don't make their art. They are directing the making of the art, but their hand is removed from the actual creation of the artifact itself.
Then I think it's probably all, that would be, I mean, they're definitely on the experience side of things, which probably makes it easier to let go of the artifact, because the artifact is always going to be secondary to the platonic ideal they had in their mind. You know, I want this shape to be like this, says Richard Serra. And the guy builds it, and there's no way it's ever going to be as perfect as what he thought of in his mind, you know, when he like backed up into 3D space in his head, you know,
right,
and had some curve.
That's probably
the best of both worlds, right? Not only are you making a lot of money, you're able to have to worry about the artifact, and you still get all the experience from it.
Is there a change in inherent value, or even perceived value, the further the artist's hand is away from the actual creation of the work?
Like a photographer who shoots film but doesn't make his own prints or whatever.
Why is that different? I guess the argument is that it's going to be degrees of difference from the negative.
Yeah.
Whereas if I've got a napkin sketch and I go make this
right
to somebody else and they make it, there's more room for interpretation. I mean, I guess you could argue it either way, because a lot of the
choreographers in dance, right there.
Yeah.
You know, they're not, unless they're in the dance, they're not dancing the dance. You know, I had a lunch with my friend Cisco the other day, dancer.
Heard of him.
Yeah.
Yep.
My professional dancer, Francisco. And we were having this conversation.
He's also a terrific photographer, by the way.
He's an excellent photographer. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Been putting a lot of stuff up on Instagram, although I don't know what his handle is off the top of my head.
Dancer guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Super good looking dancer, Cisco. Anyway, Cisco and I were talking about dance, and he brought up something that I hadn't really thought about much, which was that dance, you know, a person standing naked in a field, like in the middle of nowhere or whatever, requires no technology of any kind. And
believe me, I know.
Just the idea that dance is so pure that it doesn't even involve other things that, you know what I mean?
Right.
It's just a human body in motion, which is fascinating when you really think about it. It doesn't require a camera. It doesn't require pigments. It doesn't require a chisel. You know, it is so pure as to be only the person, you know. It doesn't even require language. You know, it was an interesting way of thinking about it that I hadn't thought about. I think that you and I sit and we talk about and we obsess, right?
A little bit, yeah.
I was listening to the other day to there's this podcast that Syracusa and Marco do called ATP. Have you heard this?
Accidental Tech, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Do you listen?
Yeah.
Okay. So the other day, after the end of the show, they usually go off about something somewhat related, but not really related. And they were going off about, they had like a 25-minute discussion about the cars at the Detroit Auto Show.
Okay.
Because there's a new Acura NSX and there's a new Ford something or other. And I know enough about this stuff to know what they're talking about, but not enough to be invested in their conversation. And sometimes I listen to it and I was listening to them talking about this stuff and talking about the shape of the grill on the new Ford GT and how it is inspired by the 1967 one, but it's different because it's a larger aperture on the holes or whatever the thing is, right?
Right, right.
And I go, oh my God, these people sound crazy. Is that what Jeffrey and I sound like?
Yes.
To people who aren't into what we're into?
Yes.
Right?
And to some people who are.
Yeah. And it kind of made me think that you and I, and this is gonna, do we worry too much about stuff that really doesn't matter that much?
Yes.
Yeah.
But the question is how the F do you stop?
Right? You try to get out, they pull you back in.
It's true. How do you stop? And this. To go full circle back to the top with the set for life thing. Her way of thinking is just as foreign to me as mine is to her. My obsessive nature is to her.
And
your obsessive nature.
Yeah. In some ways though, her goal is a fantasy, right? That's happily ever after, which we all know doesn't exist. Two people are going to get married and everything's going to go perfect for them for the rest of time because they're married. You know, it's like life doesn't work that way.
It does indeed. I take umbrage with that. It does.
What do you mean?
It does work out that way.
It does.
Maybe it doesn't work for you. Maybe it doesn't work for me, but it does work that way. It worked that way for my grandparents. I've seen it work that way.
Yeah. But like, even when they were doing their job, working their job, other life came in other ways. Somebody gets sick. Somebody gets hit by a car. Somebody gets, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Things happen. Life happens, you know?
Sure. But to say that there is no such thing as happy ever after, that's a little too cynical for me. And I've taken the cynical pill, but.
Oh, I don't mean it as cynically. There. I just mean it as realistically. I'm not saying everything is going to go into hell once you like. I just think the idea that you're ever actually done is a fantasy. You know, life is not like a box of chocolates. You know, like once all the chocolates are eaten, there's always more chocolates. You know, and.
I'll have to noodle on that and get back to you.
Okay.
I don't know if I agree with that.
I just think that, you know, you get the job where you make the thing. Well, you know what? Life isn't about money, as we all know. So there will be other things that will try you, you know, assuming that just because you have a good job means that everything else is going to fall into place is insane.
That I will grant you. Yes. Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
But people talk about it as if that's the panacea. That's the end all be all, you know, for whatever reason.
Right.
I just think
if I just get this promotion, then everything's going to be fine.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. If I just get the break that I want, you know, and I do the, you know, get some TV show. We watched all of that TV show Ed in the last few weeks. Remember the bowling alley lawyer one
from the '90s?
Yeah. It was actually from the 2000s.
Okay.
Yeah. Bowling alley lawyer guy goes back to his hometown. Anyway.
Sure. Sure.
Heather and I got stuck on talking about it one day and I found it's available nowhere, by the way. There's no DVDs. It's not available on any of the streaming services, but I found like a 8-year-old torrent ripped from VHS tapes. You know what I mean? Like one of those things, you know, just cause I really wanted to see it.
Shame on you.
I know. I'm a terrible, terrible guy. Hey, had it been available, I would have bought it. So we watched this whole show and there's all these, you know, really good actors. They had this show for 4 years. And I was like, whatever happened to like that guy and that guy and that guy. And, you know, one of them's on the, is the mom on, whatever that Modern Family, you know, she's big and powerful and the other guy's on Flash. But then there's other people who end up playing like little tiny bit parts on CSI. It's like they probably thought, hey, I'm on this show for 4 years on NBC. I've got it made, you know.
Right.
And then the
it's
show
the
ends.
Next Friends.
Exactly. And, you know, and hey, it did well in its time, but then it ended and that didn't mean they were going to get something else, you know, because mm-hmm. it's like, you know, life goes on. I don't know. It's just interesting. But yeah, go think on that and we'll discuss more later.
Yeah, I'd like to ponder that for a little bit.
And while you're pondering that, let's talk about our sponsor, Squarespace.
Oh, man. See, I had this whole thing. I had this whole Dylan thing because I thought we were going to do tutorials.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So here it is.
So you don't have...
Just real quick.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Hey, Bill. Mm-hmm. You know what Bob Dylan thinks about when he's retouching photos?
Oh, God. What does he think about when he's retouching photos, Jeffrey?
How does it heal?
Oh, God, that's sad. Have you suddenly become like a grandfather since I've last talked to you?
Wow. And then I had this whole thing it was this whole thing. It's like, now grab the brush too. Don't look like a damn fool. You know, it's just going to be this whole, it's going to be this great thing, but you screwed me.
Well, okay. We'll do that next time.
All right. That's okay. I guess this other sponsor's okay.
Yeah. I like when Dan sometimes goes, yeah, we have a new upstart sponsor here called Squarespace.
Yeah. They're new to the game.
Yeah, they're just getting started.
Squarespace?
Yeah.
Square. Yeah. We need to get the MailKimp kid to read Kemp. Square.
Squarespace?
Squarespace?
Yeah. Hey, Squarespace.com.
.com.
That one's good. I like that one.
Yeah.
Well, we're in rare form today.
Seven. Squarespace 7.
Okay,
now.
Yeah. So here's the thing, guys. Squarespace... If you haven't built a site with Squarespace, go do that right now because they're amazing. Squarespace.com /OTP.
Your site is Squarespace.
My site is Squarespace. The super fantastic Nerd Hour Squarespace's site is Squarespace. You know, every time I go on there, I think
ATP is Squarespace too, isn't it?
I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know if I ever saw their website. Look, you've heard us talk about Squarespace before. And now they've got their new version, Squarespace 7.
7.
They made everything even simpler and easier to use while retaining all the power and complexity of Squarespace's platform that you already know. It's really great. What they've basically done is turned the admin portion of your website into just a sidebar on your website. So you just kind of slide it out and then you can make changes to your website right there while looking at your website, which is fantastic.
Right. Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah. So they took all the powerful features of Squarespace 6, put them into Squarespace 7, refined it, made it seamless, unified experience. They've uncluttered the workspace. They've simplified the whole website making process by letting you add content, customize your design all in one window. So you're going to spend even less time building this site, more time doing what you love, and your stuff's still going to look great, especially if you're a band. You see these new templates they have for like musicians and stuff?
Yeah, they're like band templates.
Makes me want to go start a restaurant with a band in it.
Right.
The whole band plays at the restaurant. It's like a Josie and the Pussycats thing.
Bill's Grub Room.
Yeah. My sister sent me a picture yesterday of a thing called Billy's Place, like an old saloon.
Josie and the Pussycats. What an idiot.
Josie and the Pussycats. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code OTP. And get yourself started right now. There's some great new features, Squarespace, like cover pages. Yep. Sometimes you just need a simple page to communicate your personal brand, promote a new product, announce your latest album, put up a we're building out the rest of the site kind of thing. You can do that with cover pages and you get all the power of Squarespace on a single beautiful page. You get everything all in one place, which is amazing. And Squarespace is partnered with Getty Images to bring you Getty Images integration. Get access to over 40 million professional stock photos that ordinarily cost hundreds, sometimes thousands of dollars per image. And you can put them in your blog posts and that kind of stuff if you're trying to and go ahead.
Can I tell you, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead.
But they have the best looking stats page ever.
Yeah, they do.
It's pretty great. It's animated and they're these sort of little Bezier curves. They're just good looking.
Are you making Bezier curves?
I am.
So for only $10 an image, you can use Getty Images on your website, which is pretty amazing, just to Squarespace customers. They've also got these tastemaker templates now. Squarespace is working with cool musicians, artists, architects, chefs to develop new templates that cater to each profession. Use the same designs as the world's most influential people, then customize them to make them your own. It's great. So
they need to get that Pharrell Williams guy to do a template.
Why? Because it would be really happy.
Yes.
I am happy.
Did you use Squarespace?
I'll get to that in a second. So go get started with a free trial, no credit card required, and build your website today. Go start today. When you sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code OTP, and you'll get 10% off and show your support for On Taking Pictures. So thank you to Squarespace so much for their continued support of 5x5 and On Taking Pictures. Squarespace, a better web starts with your website. Have you ever
A better web starts with my website.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Did you ever see the video of Representative John Lewis dancing to Pharrell's Happy?
Yes.
It's pretty genius.
Yes.
I like that guy.
Almost as funny as the cop wailing out Taylor Swift's song on his dashboard cam.
Oh, yeah. That was a recent one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just going to put this in here on the thing because it's just really cute.
Okay.
I'll put it in the show notes. All right. So we got some
Here's a little audio thing for you to geek out and chime in with your audio geekery about. This was actually interesting. NPR story on the British Library's collection of recorded sound. And they've got 6 million, I think, pieces of audio that they're trying to preserve. And what did they say? They're in 40 different formats.
Yeah, over 40 different formats, including one which I, as an audio nerd, had never heard of, which kind of surprised me because I'm usually...
Like you could name 40 formats. Fronting, Bill.
See, I couldn't name them, but I'd never heard of a dicta belt. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, but the crazy thing he said was, okay, two things that I found interesting in this. One was that this analog stuff was degrading, which of course it does, which is why, you know, the digital and analog both need to be backed up on the other, you know, arguably. So print out your photos, but also have the digital copies and scan all the printed photos from your childhood.
Yeah.
But for audio stuff, it's like, yeah, digital and analog maybe. But they were saying that it would take them, 50 years at their current rate
At their current rate, it would take them 48 years to digitize. And they've got a window, according to Will Prentice, they've got a window on some of these recordings of about 15 years before they're beyond repair or beyond restoration or capture.
I own a Edison wax cylinder record player.
When I was in college, my theater history class taught by, what was his name? Stan Kahan.
Okay.
Stan Kahan. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant theater historian. One of the things he did was he made a VHS tape of all the great sword fights ever captured on film. So there were all these sort of Basil Rathbone. Sure. And it was fantastic.
So it's, anyway. And The Princess Bride, of course.
Old school. old stuff. Kidding. Anyway, so he brought in a recording of a fellow named Alessandro Moreschi, who was the last actual castrato singer.
Wow.
And it was a recording of Alessandro made on a wax cylinder when he was like 62 years old. And Bill, I got to tell you, it was the most ethereal vocal I've ever heard.
Yeah,
it was
a
just
weird sound.
Haunting.
Yeah.
Very strange.
Ugh, freaks me out a little bit.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool listening to this stuff because they play a few of them. You know, mm-hmm, they play like mm-hmm. wax cylinders from 1890 and Florence Nightingale talking and that kind of stuff.
That was the thing. They've got an actual recording, one of the very few, from an 1890 wax cylinder of her.
Well, okay. So there's two things to say about this, and this is related to the next thing down on the list. So we'll kind of wrap these two together in a second.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that there is all of this stuff that people made that is just sort of decaying, going backwards, like entropy is just eating it away, you know?
Yep.
How does that make you feel? Does that bother you at all, or do you find it beautiful in the decay?
I find it beautiful because there is this hubris where, you know, I am man, I will live forever. My creation. No, you're a blip.
Yeah.
You're a blip.
Yeah.
You know, what's the Fight Club? On a long enough timeline, the life expectancy of anything goes to zero.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I mean, even like I was even discussing that with the guy last week. I was just like, you know, in 2000 years, will people be talking about the AIDS epidemic, which lasted 3 decades or whatever it is, you know, until we came up with some cure 5 years from now or whatever, you know, or will it just be like this weird blip, like every other battle or, you know, how many people talk about the 1918 flu epidemic, you know, that killed 20 million people or whatever it is in a year, you know, it's just like things, once they get out of living memory, it's this strange thing that happens, you know, it's upsetting and weird, you know, but you put this other thing in here about this rescued film project.
Did you like this? I thought you'd like this.
I do like this. I am interested in... Okay, did you read what goes on about giving him your film? So this is some guy named... What's the guy's name? Does he even say what his name is? I'm sure he does at the beginning.
Okay, while you're looking that up, basically the genesis of this is 70 plus years ago, an American World War II soldier took a bunch of film.
Yeah.
Took a bunch of pictures. And I think it was 2 1/4 film.
Looked like it was 2 1/4 or 6:20 or something like that.
And the roles were never developed.
Yeah.
So these things were found in last year and processed. And it's incredible, actually. I think it's kind of incredible.
Well, it's but this is part of a larger project where he will take any film that you don't know what's on it and you can send it to him and he'll process it and he'll send you digital copies of any discernible images for your personal use.
Will he also send you back the negatives? I didn't get that.
I don't think so. Because if you read the form, down the bottom of the form, it says, by donating your rescued film to the Rescued Film Project, in exchange for digital copies of all images recovered from donated film for personal use only, you agree to release full print and published copyright of all images recovered from the film to the Rescued Film Project.
I did not see that.
Yeah. Basically, this guy is, this is the cynical view, this guy is looking for the next Vivian Mayer. Right?
Right.
Oh, who has film in their closet? They don't know. Well, I'll take them.
Which I have a thing about that that's down a little further.
I know, I saw that. Yeah.
Let's move that.
Okay.
Let me move. You keep going.
But interesting, right? Like the cynical view is that this guy is just trying to hoard up pictures to see if he could find something that he can make money on. You know, that he, but I will put that aside for a minute and say that there's this video of him processing the film, you know, a few rolls at a time in his kitchen. Okay, so in the video, he makes a comment about how, you know, with film this old and this unknown in condition, you can't just batch process it. You need to do them like a handful at a time or whatever it is. And it's kind of like, well, you don't...
I would say that's true.
Okay, here's the question. I mean, other than like the frailty of the film, so you have to be more careful with it as you process it. You could argue that it's not like he is taking a clipping and figuring out the right settings or to know to overexpose or underexpose, you know, to push or pull the film in processing. He's just processing it. So in many ways, wouldn't batch processing it actually be more equal? You know what I mean? Like more.
I see what you're saying. In terms of across the whole range.
Yeah. Like wouldn't he get
maybe
better quality by doing it in a more batched process versus doing one at a time where he's making changes each time that are, you know,
I don't know. Maybe the argument is there's more control over agitation, over temperature.
Yeah, maybe. I just figured the
consistency of chemistry.
I would have thought that the consistency would be better in a batch thing, you know?
Yeah, but maybe, I don't know.
Maybe I'm wrong. Anyway, it's just interesting. So he's batch processing processing these things a few rolls at a time, and then he's scanning them and letting the archive available online. So it's rescuedfilm.com, and you can go to the Rescued Latest page and look at all of the stuff that that he's most recently put up, which is pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it is.
It's a really neat idea.
I dig this a lot.
Yeah, I imagine you would. This is, though, imagine how much time he's spending on this. He even made an allusion to like that his friends and his family are just like, what are you doing spending all that time and money on this? I also wonder.
But I applaud if this is, you know, passion, cynicism aside, I applaud the passion. Yeah. I applaud the dedication.
I wonder what happens when he gets a roll of Kodachrome. Can't do anything with it.
Can you can't do anything.
Can you hand process Kodachrome?
I don't know. Can you?
Somebody must have come up with a way to do it.
That would, wow. I mean, and where would you get the chemistry in small batches?
That's the thing. I mean, I know they say, all the chemistry is gone. It's like, it can't be gone. You know what I mean? Oh, here we go. Unfortunately, there are no chemicals that I've heard of available for hand processing.
Ralph Dickinson?
Yeah. Wait, you can process it with what? Standard black and white guidelines?
What?
To bring out the color tones in between the sepia and orange, return to bleach and then redevelop once again for 12. Okay, so basically you're not going to end up with Kodachrome. You're going to end up with something else. I'll put that like in the show notes too. That's interesting. Anyway, I think that the guy's, if his heart is actually in the right place and I can put my cynicism aside, like, good for him, you know?
Yeah.
If it is all just a cover for trying to get access and the rights to a bunch of pictures.
Vivian Mayer.
Yeah.
Maloof.
Then that feels weird to me.
Yes.
It's interesting. Have you ever, going through your father's things or whatever it is, did you find any like unprocessed film?
No. I found film that I had never seen before.
But nothing that was not, you didn't know what was on it.
No, I found a lot of Super 8 movie film that I'd never seen before. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's out. It's in a box now.
We found a bunch of Super 8 rolls up at Conrad's mother's house last time we were up there at Christmas, and we took them because we're going to send them into Scan Cafe to get them converted.
Scan Cafe, that's who I should. See, I found some that's film, 8mm film of my grandparents on vacation in Europe.
Yeah, yeah. I have found an 8mm projector, threaded it through, projected it onto like a white wall or a white piece of paper, and then just off axis, filmed it with like my 5D,
mm-hmm.
and it works. So if you can do that, it's a way to transfer it.
Okay.
But it is not quite as, it's not as easy as it should be. And you get a little more flickering because your frame rate and their frame rate might be a little out of sync. Mm-hmm. But it's fine if you just want to like sort of get a digital copy of it, you know, to have
somewhere
else.
Yeah. I would just like to have one kind of for posterity. Yeah,
I did that. There's a bunch of old stuff from my family up on Vimeo that.
Oh, no kidding.
Of my mother as a teenager. You know what?
I will do some tests of that. I'll try and do it for the next show and maybe we can put links to each of them and kind of compare.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Love that.
So, really good stuff. I think it's fascinating. I worry. I'm cynical about this stuff. I worry. You know? Yeah,
well, you know, business is a dirty word to you, and that's kind of core to your being. It's not
You know what this? You know, okay. Assuming for the moment my worst fears about this,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Assuming that those are true, which I'm not saying that they are. This guy's probably in it for the right reasons. Whatever it is, it feels predatory, and that's what bothers me about it. You know, it's sort of like, oh yeah, just send me your film. I want to find out what's on it. And like, whoa, I'm going to sell them for millions of dollars in a big book and have a movie that's going to win, you know?
Right.
That's my fear. Speaking of that kind of stuff. Yeah. Finding Vivian Mayer got an Oscar nod. Although I'm not surprised. It was a very popular documentary from last year.
It was popular, but I watched it again. It's not very good.
I haven't even seen it yet, so I can't comment.
It's not very good. And the thing that bothers me about it is some of the things that they reference in the article. First of all, the title, Finding Vivian Mayer.
Yeah.
So right off the bat,
you're assuming that she was lost.
Well, no, it's Maloof is casting himself as the protagonist. He's the hero who has found Vivian Mayer.
Well, this is what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and the other thing is, you know, there's no mention of the other people who found Vivian Mayer, who then Maloof purchased the remaining materials from.
Yeah.
You know, it's like he wants to cast himself as this sole champion who found, and it's just, that's the icky part.
He who wins, you know, writes history.
Yeah.
History goes to the victors.
He
was the guy smart enough when had the money to buy the stuff off the other guys. So suckers, you know.
Yeah.
A little bit of that.
It wasn't a good movie.
This article that you just put up from Slate, basically, what is the title? Vivian Mayer's, is it Mayer or Mayer?
I don't know. Whatever. Okay.
Vivian Mayer's photographs are stunning, but the Oscar-nominated movie about her is a mess, is the title.
It is. You know, and they bring up, you know, the Jodorowsky's Dune that didn't get nominated. And that was an amazingly cool documentary.
Yeah.
About somebody who, you know, you wouldn't have otherwise known about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most people, anyway. Here. Maloof refused to participate in a 2013 BBC documentary about the photographer because it contradicted the version of events he narrates here, in which he is the sole discoverer of the work at a 2007 auction. In fact, two other Chicago-based collectors had also acquired some of Mayer's possessions around that time and had, like Maloof, begun to discover prints and negatives in the many boxes and suitcases that Mayer, who was among other eccentricities a hoarder, had left behind at her death of 83. But Finding Vivian Mayer makes no mention of these rival collectors, presenting Maloof as Mayer's lone champion and heroic rescuer. Yeah, it's just, it's he seems to be in it for him via her.
Yes.
And I don't like that. I don't like that.
I see, you know how sometimes we talk about artists constructing their own narrative of themselves, yes, you know, to put their best foot forward for business reasons or whatever it is. And I'm always a little weary of that, of rewriting my own thing. There was it was one of those full blogger article things where he asked a bunch of people what they're going to do next year. And I was one of them. And I sent him what I was planning to do in photographically in the next year, whatever it is. And Chris Gampett over at Photographer was like, wow, this is the most honest, best answer I've heard so far, or whatever it is. And I was just like, well, it shows that I don't know what I'm going to do in the next year, which is true. You know, like I could write a PR sounding thing if you really want to, that makes me sound like I'm the next coming of Tony Stark in the photo world, you know?
Right.
But like, I can't portray myself that way. It's like, I would have a really hard time, even if I did find Vivian Mayer's stuff, to do anything other than a documentary about her work and what I found out about her that had nothing to do with me. You know what I mean? Like I would feel wrong doing that.
You should be
a
supporting character, not the star.
Yes. You know,
and I don't feel like Vivian Mayer nor her work is the star of this film.
The only thing that you could take away from that, if you and I are right in this case, is that unless he goes and finds somebody else's amazing work, you know,
right?
Like if he's sucking off the teat of Vivian Mayer's work, you know, it's like, where does that go? You know, how does that scale?
Right.
Interesting. I'm going to go watch the movie, so then we can discuss for real after all this time.
Okay.
What else we got?
You've got this.
Oh, do you see this?
Wallace Koopman. Yeah, this is interesting.
Our good friend Alan Bellworth sent this over. Apparently, this Wallace Koopman's is a friend of his.
Hmm.
And so he took 3,000 cell phone images over 8 months, which is a lot of pictures. Is that a lot of pictures? What is
like
8 months is what, like 240 days divided by, you know, so he's taken 10 pictures a day, which is a lot. And he put them in a big giant grid, right?
Right. And like a mosaic.
Yeah. And he's going to, over time, he's going to look at it. And when he can't remember when he took that picture, he's going to blot it out.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's kind of neat. It's a neat idea. Because these things, so many of our pictures that we take, especially with phones, because we take so many, you don't really remember where it's from. You know?
And it's a big print.
It's 40 by 60.
Yeah, 40 by 60.
Yeah. And you can, there's a place here you can zoom in on it, which is kind of neat. I've got to go look at it this way. What do you think of this idea? Because this kind of goes back to our stuff last week when we were talking about sticking your pictures in a time capsule.
Right. I like it. I don't know about the idea of blotting it out.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me.
Well, I mean, it's a performance art piece as much as it is, you know, right?
Yeah. Although I think I've referenced this before. There's a great John Hurt interview that he did for Dunhill that he begins by saying, I'd rather have memory than photographs. Because however inaccurate, I prefer my own memory than to be tied to the tedium of a photograph.
Yeah.
The tedious reality of a photograph, I think is what he said.
Yeah, it's true. I always thought that if, like at my wedding, I won't really take that many pictures, you know? It's like,
yeah, well, why bother?
I prefer the moment, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't need video of that, you know?
Yeah, this is interesting. So go look at the show notes.
And, yeah, we're going to put in the show notes.
Yeah, it's
wkoopmans.ca. So we'll put in the show notes. But I think it's an interesting idea because I do think that we are very flippant about imagery now. You know, like we have the ability to take so much that we end up taking more than we probably need to and then never look at it again, you know.
Yes.
Even looking at my own phone, because I cleared everything off when my phone broke and whatever a couple months ago.
Right.
And then when I got settled in on a new phone, I sort of started with a clean slate. And I have 152 pictures in here, which is nothing for, you know, a couple months for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's been a couple months, no.
I just don't take that many pictures with my phone. But even in here, there are a few pictures that I'm kind of like, wait, when did I take that? You know, that I don't even remember taking.
Mm.
You know, so that says something too.
Sure.
You know what I found the other day while searching around was a Blockbuster movie card.
Nice.
What a weird thing that was.
Are they still in business?
No, I think they're all gone.
I think they're gone.
Isn't that crazy though? That such a huge monolithic thing is gone.
Yeah. Well,
it's crazy.
It happens.
Look, if you want to take pictures with your phone and you want to remember them.
What do you think of this? You like this?
I think it's a neat idea. So this is White Album.
It's an app for the iPhone called White Album.
Yeah.
And preview, no delete.
So you take a picture and then you can't get to it.
No.
And you can take 24 photos, like a short roll of film.
Right.
And then you pay $20 and they send you those 24 pictures as prints.
Right. And you can choose whether to have a square or a circular mat around them. And the prints are 4x5.
Yeah. What do you think?
I'm going to do this. I would love to get some people on board with this, and maybe say, you know, in the month of February or even March, let's do a few of these and we'll share our prints with each other.
Okay. I think the price is too high.
$20 for a roll of film?
Yeah.
How much is it to process and print a roll of 24?
Well, I will tell you that if you took 24 pictures and brought and uploaded them to, you know, CVS and went and picked them up, which you can do now, by the way, which really works. I did it on my mother's phone. She's like, how do I print these pictures? And I was like, you could send them away. And it turns out the CVS app, you could just upload pictures from your phone straight to CVS. You go pick them up an hour later.
Really?
Yeah. And it's 29 cents a print or something like
that. What?
Yeah.
Wait.
The CVS app, and I'm sure there's a Walgreens app and a whatever app.
I have a CVS right up the street.
Yeah, there's a CVS, the main CVS app has a photo thing in it, and you can upload stuff to get printed. You just go pick it up at your local store.
CVS app store, CVS pharmacy? No, I don't want that.
Yeah, it's the CVS pharmacy app. In fact, let me see if I have it on here. Yep, I have CVS, it's called CVS pharmacy, and inside of it, yeah, I think you have to.
Does it really look this horrible?
Oh, it's a terrible, terrible website. But one of the things about it is that you can go in and go Photo Center and you can upload, print from your phone.
What?
And you can print straight from your phone and go pick up prints. And my mother did it and the prints looked really good. Like, not like really good, like, oh my God, but like they looked great. And you can go pick it up.
Does Target have one as well?
I'm sure. So anyway, the point is that I think they charge 50 cents, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, $20 is a little pricey, you know. But you know, it's
I was all excited that I found something cool. You
sorry.
Screw me.
What are you talking about? Screw you. I gave you a better option.
Shoot me down. See how it is.
By the way, go look at the White Album website, right?
Right.
And look how creepy, when you really look at it, the picture, the finger that's about to press the button, look how weird in Photoshop that is.
Yeah, it's not.
It's terrible. Like elongated and terrible.
Yeah, it is kind of strange.
It looks like an alien picture. It's like, okay, ET, so maybe is we about don't to press the button.
Okay, maybe we don't want to do this.
Well, the nice thing about this.
You're pointing it out, though. It's expensive. You're right.
It's expensive. And I do like the idea, though, that you don't see it, right? That you're shooting it like a roll of film.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there's other apps that do that where it doesn't give kimping.
Hey, what are you doing? I'm kimping my photos.
Why do you keep looking at the back of the camera? I'm kimping. Anyway, cool stuff. But yeah, I'm sure Target has one too.
I wonder, can you bring in your phone and just plug your phone in?
Yes, you can do that too. Although, I mean, honestly, I'd almost rather do it through the app rather than plug something into my phone, which seems a little more unsafe sex to me. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And it totally worked. And it, like, she got a text or an email like an hour later saying, yeah, you can come pick them up.
Oh, wait, here. Better choice. The Kodak Kiosk Connect app.
Where are their Kodak kiosks?
CVS, Target.
There you go. So there you go. So my point is that there are ways to do this without having to wait for them to ship to you, you know?
Oh, but the only 2-star reviews on this thing.
All right. Well, try the CVS one. It worked great for me.
That's very cool. Okay. Well, there you go, listeners.
So white album app. Pff.
Screw them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, good for that. It's a neat idea. Very hipster. Yeah. Very hipster.
Well, it does come in a little plastic box. Oh, no, it's not plastic. It's cardboard. Nah, that's too bad. See, okay. So for $20, here.
Yeah,
addendum. Yeah. Addendum. Look, yeah. I'm calling an audible.
Oh, you get the little box.
Nope. Okay. Nope. I'm calling an audible because better choice than for the same money.
Yeah.
Go to heymosaic.com. You can get a book for $20.
Okay. So if you're going to spend $20, better way to do $20. Yeah. Bucks?
It's a 7x7 book of photographs. And I've seen these. They look terrific. And they're in this cool little box, and it's a hardcover, and it's got like a little cutout. So
how many pictures you put in there?
20.
Okay. So same, around the same amount.
Yeah.
It's good stuff. Anyway, the idea that you can, the point is that you could get stuff printed. If you want prints and you're like, I don't want to buy a printer and I don't want to do that. It's like, you don't need to. You just need to have a CVS near you or a Target or a whatever, or any one of these things, you know,
right.
Depending on whether you want to wait or not. I also got sent in this Robert Frank archives. Did you see this? So
is this the thing where they've put all the archives up online?
Yeah, the National Gallery of Art.
Yeah,
you can go look through all the stuff.
You can go and research.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
And a lot of it has sheets like work panels and different contact sheets.
I would like a print of his contact sheet.
Well, you could probably do that.
Can you get that?
Sure. You know what I always realize that I do with film? It's like film wants to be overexposed. It's better when it's overexposed rather than underexposed. And I shoot digital so much that I usually go slightly the other way because, you know, once you clip, you're screwed in digital. Mm-hmm. Where film pushes back so you get this nice feel in stuff that ends up, you know, getting baked in. Anyway, just something I've noticed. Yeah, it's very, very cool stuff. And you can go in, see a bunch of prints from it. There's contact sheets, all kinds of crazy stuff you could see. So you can look through all of Robert Frank's stuff. You could spend days here clicking through this stuff. I wish the images were a little bigger.
What if when you go there, like if you went to the National Gallery,
can you check out his archives?
Can you look at the things? Yeah.
I'm sure if you wrote them and got permission, you know. I'm not sure if you could just walk off the street, but if you wrote the person and said, hey, I'm doing research for, you know, this article I'm writing or whatever, I'm sure you could do it. That's what these places are there for, you know. I don't think they'd let you do it.
Right. Well, why would they?
Well, you're shady. Have you looked at yourself in the mirror lately?
I'm rough. I'm really letting myself go. Rough.
So anyway, that's pretty cool. It's a National Gallery of Art website has Robert Frank stuff. And if you haven't looked that much at Robert Frank stuff, go look at Robert Frank stuff, because you can see all kinds of stuff in there.
Good stuff.
Anything else we got? Oh, The Verge put this up this morning, and I just thought you'd get a kick out of it, which is an article after all the time of use your phone for everything. Some guy's just like, I regret using an iPhone to capture some of the best moments of my life. It's called Why You Should Stop Relying on Your Phone and Buy a Nice Camera. So the pendulum swings back the other direction. You know,
I think you buy the right tool for the job. Yeah. If you're displaying things on the web and on Facebook and on Twitter and on Instagram, you know, an iPhone is a terrific, or, you know,
yep,
any camera phone is a terrific solution. If you need to make 30 by 40 prints, or you need, you know, lenses and more control and granularity and all that, then it's not the right thing.
His vote is for the X100T.
Supposed to be a terrific camera.
Yep. I'm going to wait one more generation and maybe give it another shot.
I think the X Pro 2 is going to be a stunner.
The X Pro 2 or the next version of the X100, if they make an X200, you know, like the next like big jump. Every time I look at the JPEGs from my Italy trip, I'm just like, these are just beautiful files. Whoever is doing, you know, what's kind of amazing to me is that the JPEGs that come out of camera on Canon and Nikon cameras aren't of the same quality as the ones that come out of the Fuji cameras. They're just, whoever's doing the de-unbayering, but it's not really Bayer sensors, but you know what I mean?
Right.
The person who's writing the software for doing the processing on those cameras is doing a wonderful job, both color and resolution and everything like that. They're just great.
Yep.
I like those X-Trans sensors. They just need to make bigger ones. They need to make one that's 2.25 by 2.25 that collects on the back of my Hasselblad.
Well, yeah.
That I would pay 10 grand for.
The rumor is that the next X Pro will be 24. So there's a pretty sizable jump there.
Yeah, no, 24 is 16 is not quite enough. 24 is more than enough, you know, for what I would like personally. I'll put that link in the show notes. You can go read it if you feel like you want to buy a camera or think this guy is full of crap.
Yeah.
Probably he is. So how did Best of 2014 do?
Man, there are some really, really, really good photos. A lot of new photos.
A lot of people came back, I noticed, who were just like, I haven't been around in a while, but here I am.
Across the board, a lot of family stuff, a lot of landscape stuff, a lot of, portraiture. There's some photo shoot, you know, more formal photo shoots. I'm kind of blown away by not only the quality of the work, but the variety of the work.
Well, we have people of all ilks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, well done, you guys. And it seems everyone is really enjoying everyone else's work. You know, there's a lot of sort of mutual admiration, and I really like that.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
Absolutely. It's good stuff. Oh, by the way, did you see that we got called out on Twitter? For our comment last week that was it Gardner's daughter wasn't his daughter?
And she wrote like, us. Yes, I am his daughter.
So, and I said, I still don't believe it. And she goes, ha, at times, neither can I.
Yeah.
I like her. She's funny.
Yes.
Oh, that's funny. Anyway, I just thought that was funny.
Wait, is it Piper?
Yeah, I think it's Piper or something. Yeah.
So thank you, Piper, for setting us straight. But
that was funny. We liked that.
Yeah.
So everyone did really well.
He's a funny guy.
He is a funny guy.
Yeah, you get him with Freddie, and that's a pretty
hilarity ensues.
Yeah.
What's the plan for next week?
So what did we decide? Redux. So
right.
This is like, you know, this is like independent study in high school. Go back and what was your favorite assignment and your favorite challenge and reshoot it and see if you do it differently and see what else you come up with.
I think it's a good idea. Try something, like go back and try it again.
Or if you've got something that you like, reprocess it. Maybe you didn't like the processing on it.
You know what's interesting about that is that you could see it as, I want to do something different, or you could see it as, I want to do it better.
Right, right.
You know, like, oh, I think that picture was really good, but the lighting wasn't quite right. Or, you know, it was the wrong shirt or whatever.
Yep.
You know, yeah, I like that one, Redux.
Redux.
All right, I will put that in the show notes. Ah, Redux. Hey, so photographer of the week this week?
Hit me. What do you got?
Andre Pandela. I think
that's Andre Pandela.
This guy, I think that's Pandele. He's
Pandal?
Yeah, Pandal? Pandale?
Pandal?
He's Romanian. Where would that does that help you at all?
Let's see. What do we got here?
You actually going to do the Google search?
I am.
Okay. So this guy was a young architect in Romania in the 1970s. Somebody sent this in. I'll have to find out who sent it in because it's really good. And he started taking pictures all through the 70s and through the 80s. And it's like a record of what it was like, you know, in communist Romania during the 70s and 80s. And I find this whole idea fascinating. It's funny. There's one in the, go to the BBC article, Jeffrey, and scroll down there. Towards the bottom where there's the picture of him. You see the picture of him, the little self.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The little selfie. With a,
one step up reminds me of the Kertész photo outside of Paris. Oh sure.
Yeah. Yeah. With the bridge in the background.
Yeah. You know, it's got the same kind of thing. Now, here's why I find this interesting. Both, I find it interesting because, you know, there weren't probably that many people taking photographs of what it was like in his world. There's also another link in the show notes where it's a bunch of color stuff that's up on Est and Ost, which I'm assuming means East and West. Est and Ost.
Est Ost.
You see that?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And there's some really great ones in here.
Oh, wow. That's
beautiful
really cool
stuff. Color and black and white. And what I find fascinating about this stuff is the idea that all of these millions of people were living these lives. And we don't have that much recorded stuff to show for it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like that it's certain places in the world, millions of people here in America are taking billions of pictures a year, you know, on their phones or whatever it is.
Yeah, literally.
Right. But how many people in rural China have any record of their lives from the last year, you know, visual record like that, you know?
Oh, wow. This one is really cool.
Which one's that?
On this Est.
Yep. Yep. Number what?
Number five.
Okay. Yeah. Nice work, right?
Yeah. It's really, really cool.
Oh yeah. I like that one. The woman in the mirror.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Yeah. It's lovely. So I like the idea that this is a window into a very particular time and mm-hmm. place, and I can't find out that much information about this guy.
Hmm.
I mean, like you do searches and there's stuff on this BBC page where you can like listen to people discuss stuff, but it's interesting, you know?
Hmm.
What do you think?
I like the work.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I'd like to find out more.
Yeah. But here's the thing. It's like, it may be that this guy came, shot all this stuff, disappeared, talking about our stuff getting just lost into history.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know what? A couple decades where he took a bunch of pictures that are known and on a few websites and then whew, gone. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's no wiki.
Yeah. And it just goes to show you, like, for all the guys who are out there with 700,000 pictures on their Flickr page and 4 billion followers, you know, for every Trey Radcliffe, there's a guy like this.
Right.
You know? And that popularity doesn't equal quality or vice versa, you know?
Yeah, this is really good stuff.
Yeah, it's lovely work and a window into a time and a place that it tends to get forgotten. 70s and 80s and communist East Europe, you know, it's like good stuff.
Wait, here we go. Okay. As of, well, this was as of 2010.
Okay.
Let's see. He's working on a project on the House of the People.
Where'd you find that? Just give me another link.
Here, let me give you a copy.
Got it. RomaniaInsider.com.
Yeah, it's very slow loading.
Yeah.
But a little bit of insight.
Some quotes and stuff in here. Yep. We'll put it on the show notes. Weird though, right?
Yeah.
It's just very unspoken, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But lovely work, and you should all check it out. What do you think about this, the pronunciation?
I don't know. I mean, could it be as simple as Pandel?
It could be.
Pandel. Andre Pandel?
So somebody call us or let us know how to pronounce that if you're from
Europe. Yeah, if you know how to pronounce it.
As you know, we're terrible. If you don't tell us, we're going to do it with a French accent.
Andre Pandel. Yeah. So 347-687-9411.
Yeah, leave us a voicemail. And I think that's about it. You got anything else?
Nope.
Okay. We are at podcast@ontakingpictures.com if you want to send us an email that gets to both of us. You can tweet at us at Bill Wadman, at Jeffrey Sidoris on Twitters. Jeffrey just gave you the voicemail number, and we love if you would go to iTunes and leave a review or tell some friends about the show.
Yeah, tell some friends about the show. Yeah. That's a good idea. Let's see if we can get to, like, you know,
78,000
listeners.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
Every day, every week.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that'd be good. Yeah.
But excellent. We will talk to you next week then.
Thank you for listening, everyone.
Yep.
Going on and on the way we are for so long. To any fool, it's plain to see something. This way, say what you wanna say, though I know your words will lay me out, so I can hear you think out loud. Going through your thoughts the way I have for too long. This way, say what you wanna say. I know what you will say. Will it-